Okay, it is 11 a.m., 6 p.m. in Israel. So let's learn Torah and hopefully Pikudei Hashem Yisharim B'Samchei Lev. Teaching
That's of right.
Torah makes us happy and cheerful and connects us to eternity and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's a pleasure. We'll find out last week who we were related to, who we're not related to. I don't know what we're going to do this week. He doesn't give me advance notice. Our illustrious professor here didn't give me advance notice of what we're going to be talking about. So we'll find out right now. Bakasha.
Yes. If you want, Rabbi Kelman, I will send you advance notice. I don't just decide on the morning of.
I know that. No, it's good. To be in suspense is good. It makes the sheer, okay. You know, we eagerly await to find what we're going to learn.
Very good. Okay. So last week we were dealing with the question of who are our relatives, and specifically with the question of are our spouses our relatives? And I wanted to, I didn't think that we'd finish talking about that. I'd like to begin by finishing off that topic. And that was in last week's Parsha, last week's Torah portion. And I wanted to pick up a few other issues that relate to Pshat and Midrash and Halakha in last week's Torah portion. So this will be a session that isn't just about one point. I'm hoping to have four different issues come up in this session, and I hope that I hope they'll all hold together in some way. And I'll just begin by sharing my screen, and here we go. So the question that we were talking about last week, as we said, was, is my spouse my relative? And the problem was, just to review what we did last week, so we can move on from there. We noticed that in the beginning of chapter 21 of Leviticus, there's the list of the people for whom a Kohen can go to their relatives. He's allowed to make himself tameh, make himself impure by going to the funeral of the relatives that are listed here: mother, father, son, daughter, brother, and sister. And there is no mention of spouse here. And in fact, it is arguable, it's not totally clear, but it's arguable that the last verse here is saying that he shouldn't go to the funeral of his wife. Lo yitama ba'al be'amav lehechalo ba'al da'amav, whatever that means, should not defile himself and so profane himself. So we saw that the earliest source that we have, the earliest halachic source on the subject, just like solves the problem and says, Ein she'ero ela ishto. The list of relatives here begins with the word she'ero, which most translators just say that means his relative. And the Midrash Halacha says she'ero means his wife. And so that text, with this new interpretation, is actually listing seven relatives instead of listing six relatives. And those would be the seven relatives, those of us who aren't Kohanim. This law does not apply to us, but the other laws that apply to us relate to when we sit Shiva, when we are obligated to mourn, and we are obligated to mourn for the death of seven relatives: mother, father, brother, sister, son, daughter, and spouse. So if you just take that as it is, then we've solved the problem. Of course, a spouse is my relative. That's what the Midrash Halacha said, and that finishes the discussion. But we noticed that Rambam didn't exactly buy into this, that he said that actually the end of law number one here is, Midivrehem sheitabel ha'ish al ishto. Sitting Shiva for a relative is, according to Rambam, a mitzvah from the Torah, but it's only a rabbinic law. In other words, like, Rambam looked at this and he said, this isn't exegesis, this isn't interpretation. This is the rabbis expanding the law. And that's, you know, a big question when we look at Midrash Halacha. Are we looking at something that is attempting to be interpretation? Are the rabbis attempting to say, if you look deeply into this text, you see that it's referring also to the death of a spouse? Or are the rabbis legislating? And Rambam is suggesting that what we have here is legislation. And he says that again at the end of the text, the law number seven, a priest must defile himself for his wife, in other words, attend her funeral if she dies, even against his will. The basis for this law is rabbinic, in other words, it is not Torah law. And so he's looking at that Midrash Halacha and he's saying that isn't interpretation, it's rabbinic expansion of the text. Rashi, on the other hand, says, well, that's what it means. And I gave you his the text here. I'm not going to go through all of the twists and turns in Rashi's understanding, but Rashi says that, in fact, a Kohen does go to his wife's funeral. And he says, in the continuation that I didn't give you here, but that we saw last week, he says, "V'chein pshuto shel mikra." That's the pshat. That's, you know, if you read the text carefully, if you read the text accurately, you will see this. So Rashi is like defending the Midrash Halacha and calling the Midrash Halacha pshat. It's the true interpretation of the text according to Rashi. Even Ezra, we saw, said, you know, it used to seem to me, or it would have seemed to me, that the text is saying that a Kohen doesn't go to his wife's funeral, but then I found that that the rabbi said that he does go to his wife's funeral, and then he says at the end, this is how he often relates to problems of this nature, he writes, Batel ha-perusha rishon, the first interpretation is canceled. So that's what Ibn Ezra does when he sees this this conflict between the what seems to be the plain understanding of the text, or maybe the plain understanding of the text of what the rabbi said. You know, you can't have these two contradictory, you can't be saying X and minus X at the same time. If the rabbi said the Kohen has to go to his wife's funeral, then there couldn't be a verse that says that a Kohen doesn't go to his wife's funeral. On the other hand, Rashbam, his older contemporary, maybe 10, 15 years older than Ibn Ezra, is willing to juggle two balls at the same time, like this, the pshat and the midrash ball, even when they contradict each other. We saw that, we saw this text also last time. He says, Shum ba'al be'ama kohanim lo yitama li'ishto. No husband from the company of priests is allowed to defile himself by becoming impure through contact with the dead body of his wife. And because that would make him unfit for the priesthood, but that's not what the rabbi said. So Rashbam says, on the pshat level, the Bible says one thing, and on the midrash level, the Bible says something else. And it's an amazing idea. We may talk about this some more in some future session. It's amazing idea that, you know, like if you put this into theological terms, and you ask the question, it's very difficult to answer, what exactly did Rashbam mean by this? Of course, Rashbam sees the author of this text as God. And he said, God wrote the pshat in such a way as to say to us that a Kohen should not go to his wife's funeral, but he wrote it in such a way that the Midrash says that he should go to his wife's funeral. So asking this question, which I'm not going to answer today, what does that mean? But what's God doing if he's putting into the text two contradictory messages that you can extract from the text? One, if you use pshat interpretation, and the other, if you use midrashic interpretation. And it has been argued, and I think there is some basis to this, that Rashbam's Torah commentary was not popular because of this, and because so many Jews scratched their head when they looked at a commentary like this and said, like, what's he doing here? What does it mean? You know, if somebody is a rebel against rabbinic Judaism, okay, he'll say, oh, the rabbis say this, but they're wrong, and here's what the text says. But that's clearly not Rashbam. Rashbam is extremely loyal to the rabbinic system. So why is he willing to live with this tension? Not going to answer that today, but I just point that out. We saw the very nice harmonizing approach of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who pointed out that it says here that, you know, I I shortened the biblical text. I said that the Kohen goes to the funeral of his mother, father, sister, son, daughter, brother, or sister, but the text actually says his unmarried sister, to which Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, he jumps on that fact and says, ah, we see from this that the relationship between the brother and sister becomes superseded by the relationship between the spouses. And so from this we learn, so Rav Yosef Bechor Shor is saying, and this is a very popular method in general of dealing with this problem of the tension between Pshat and Midrash, saying that if you look carefully at the text, you will see that the text actually supports the Midrash. And that's what he's arguing here, because the text says she has a husband, her brother doesn't make himself unclean, but her husband does, because that's the stronger relationship that she has. So obviously the Torah is suggesting that the relationship of spouses is stronger. Remember that this is almost like the opposite of what Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor contemporary Rambam is writing. Rambam is writing, it's only a rabbinic law that a spouse, that you sit shiva for a spouse. It's not, and Bechor Shor said, no, you look carefully in the Torah. The Torah is saying that a spouse is the strongest kind of relationship. And there's just one more text that I wanted to read that we did not get a chance to read last time. Rabbi Baruch Halevi Epstein in his work, The Torah Tmima. I'll read it in English. Those who can follow along in the Hebrew. Many struggle to interpret this midrash. She'ero means his wife. What does it mean to say that She'ero means his wife? To me, the explanation is simple. Since we have found that the Torah often uses the word She'er to refer to a family relationship between people, and since here it writes, to his She'er that is closest to him, we interpret this as a reference to his wife. Since, following the custom of the world and the ways of modesty, there is no relationship as close as the relationship of a husband and a wife. So there may be something circular here in what Rabbi Epstein is arguing here. So does the text here include wives? It lists all these relatives and it lists a bunch of them, and it doesn't have a word for wife. But he says, but it says to his close relatives, and we all know, and certainly somebody writing like this in the 20th century or in the last years of the 19th century knows that the closest relationship that people have is with their spouse. And so he says, that's what it means that She'ero, Ein She'ero Ela Ishto, She'ero means his close relative. And since we all know that our closest relative is our spouse, then there's no question. And he goes on, Rabbi Epstein is often very proud of himself for coming up with some new understanding of the text. And he writes here, all those who had difficulty understanding this Midrash made the mistake of thinking that the Talmud was saying that She'ero really means his wife. And that couldn't be the case. Think this through and all will become clear. You know, obviously, that they couldn't be saying that. As we saw last time, that's not a possible shot level of interpretation of the word she'er. And he goes on. In the laws of mourning, Rambam ruled that the fact that a Kohen attends his wife's funeral is a rabbinic law. He thinks that the Midrash, she'ero means his wife, is just an asmachta. In other words, that it is not an interpretation of the word she'ero. It is a kind of artificial attaching of the halacha to the word. We will say more about this concept of asmachta in a further session, but what he's saying here is, clearly Rambam understood that this wasn't exegesis that the rabbis were doing. This was not interpretation that they were doing. What they were actually doing was saying that this implies this It seems that he understood the word Sheiro is an introduction to the list of relatives that is enumerated after that. As we said, appears to be the simple shot reading of the text. There is much to say about this approach of his. Nevertheless, it is not impossible that he understands the language of the biblical verse in the way that I explained. I think that I can solve the whole problem of understanding how Rambam came to this by saying that Rambam agreed with me. And so, if we take the assumption that I think all of us in this session here probably take, that our closest relationship is with a spouse and that it trumps any relationship that we have with any blood relative. And as the Torah Tmima says, that's just like so obvious that is the case. Then according to the Torah Tmima, the problem disappears. Then logically, when you look at those relatives, you say kind of kal vachomer, a fortiori, if I sit Shiva for my brother, then of course I sit Shiva for my spouse because the relationship with the spouse is so much closer. Last week, I toyed a little bit with the possibility that in biblical times, people actually felt that the strongest relationship that they had was with their blood relatives and not with their spouses. But Rabbi Epstein here in the Torah Tmima says, we all know that that is not the case. We all know that the person with whom we have the strongest relationship is actually our spouse. Okay. That's issue number one that I wanted to deal with today. And with your permission, I will go on to the next issue, which is also in last week's Torah portion. And the word amav, which appears in the opening section that we read last week and that we did not talk about when we were reading the opening verses of the chapter 21 in Leviticus. What does the word amav mean? Okay, so everybody here knows that am means people, and amav means his people, is referring to the Kohen. So who are his people? And of course, the two simplest possibilities would be that his people means the Jewish people, or that his people means his tribe, the Kohanim. So the word Amav appears four times in the beginning of Vayikra. Twice in verses that are talking about all the priests. Speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, none shall defile himself for any dead person, bi'amav, lenefesh lo yitama bi'amav. Okay, that's the first time that the word appears. Second time, ba'al bi'amav shall not defile himself and so profane himself. So we talked about that verse at length last week with the ba'al there, with the possibility that ba'al actually means a husband, but we didn't talk about that second word there, bi'amav. And then we have twice in reference to the high priest. It says about the high priest, only a virgin may amav, may he take to wife. The who amana ugrishav chalalason betula me amav yikach isha. He should take a virgin, me amav, as his wife. And then the next verse after that says, so that he won't profane his offspring, be amav. Okay. So as I said, there are two ways that seem to be the most popular ways of understanding the word be'amav here, either as meaning the Jewish people or meaning the Kohen. I'm just going to throw out a little question here. I know that you're all on mute, But if anybody wants to be so bold as to answer on chat, or if you feel like unmuting yourself for a second just to answer the question, let's not get into a long discussion here, but just let me throw out a question. Do people happen to know, or would you like to guess what the halacha is? Does the high priest have to marry somebody who is a Kohenet, and who is from the tribe of the Kohanim? And I would like to ask them, maybe those people who have smicha not answer, but if anybody who doesn't, I think there are two or three people here who don't have smicha. If any of you who don't have smicha would like to answer that question about whether the high priest, okay, somebody's been brave and answered here on the chat, the high priest does not have to marry a daughter of Kohen, I think, says Ellen. Ilana says no.
Meaning, no. I think it's looked favorably. I think it's looked upon favorably when a Kohen marries from the Kohanic tribe.
Okay, good. I guess Jewish is enough. Zev says, Chaim says, according to the simple pshat, no. Okay, we're going to discuss
no.
what the simple pshat is in a second. But okay, Ellen Saffron says, no, he doesn't have to marry. Does anybody, can we get smicha if we know Epi? Oh, Epi, you certainly deserve to get smicha.
I can't use the chat. But I wonder.
Okay, so go ahead, Pearly. Tell us what you think.
No, I'm wondering the use of the word amav versus the use of the word amo.
Right.
And amav would refer, I would think, to his own group, whereas right. amo refers to the nation at large.
Okay.
So
okay.
There's the answer that I okay. get to come up with.
Very, very good. Sheila says from the text, it would appear that the word betulah would be enough, that it does not have to be a high priest. Well, all of you, not just you, Epi, everybody, I would say, who answered here is deserving of smicha, because they all knew the right halachic answer. But the question, yes, iPad says, aren't there times that women are considered a umbifneat home by the rabbis? That is true, but I don't think that that's what was meant here by Amav, a reference to that he should take a virgin who's a woman. I don't think that that's what was meant here. So all of you gave the halachic answer. Hats off to you for knowing your halacha. And now we're going to talk about, you know, like, what does the phrase actually mean? So in the comment that we saw last week from Rashbam, when he talked about verse 4, he said, Shum ba'al be'am ha-kohanim lo yitama li'ishto. That when it says ba'al be'amav, that the word amav means from the tribe of Kohanim. That's what it means in verse 4. We saw that comment last week. He also makes that comment on verse 1 when it appears in verse 1, where it says, Lenefesh lo yitama be'amav. Rashbam writes, Ish be'am ha-kohanim lo yitama lenefesh adam. So he is convinced that the word am in these verses means, at least he said it in verse 4, and he said it here in verse 1, and then he writes also, Kemo betula me amav yikach isha, just as in the phrase, he shall take a virgin, me amav, as a wife. It would seem, I would argue, we'll see that maybe you can argue this in more than one direction, but I would argue that Rashbam is saying clearly here that the pshat is that a Kohen has to marry a virgin from his of Kohanim, from the priestly caste, that is required. And in fact, if you'd like an argument in favor of this, I know that none of you, when I threw open the question here, you all were unanimous about this, but I'll try to support the other position, which is, if it actually means that he's allowed to marry any Jewish virgin, what do you need the word ma'amav there for? You know, is there an assumption that the high priest might be marrying somebody who isn't Jewish? Why doesn't it just say in the previous verse, in verse 13, it says hu isha biftuleha yikach, without the word ma'amav. And then in verse 14, it says, "Betula me'amav yikach ishas." So why is it saying that he can marry somebody as long as she is Jewish? That would seem a very strange thing to be saying. So Rashbam seems to be saying here that when it says here, he shall take a virgin me'amav, he means that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, has to marry somebody from the tribe of Kohanim. Shadal, Samuel David Luzzatto, the beginning of the 19th century in Italy, quoted this comment of Rashbam and writes at the end of his quotation here, Ki lefi hapshat tzarich shetieh kohenet. Since following the pshat, Shadal disagrees with all of you. He thinks that the pshat of that phrase is betula me'amav, is that she has to be from the tribe of Kohanim. And we find that this is like a very common understanding. This Baruch Levin, a modern critical Bible scholar who wrote the commentary on Leviticus in the JPS Torah commentary. He wrote on this verse here. Again, the term kin refers specifically to the priestly clan, as was true in verses 1 and 4. This means that the high priest must marry a virgin from a priestly family. Verse 15 reasons that if he were to marry outside the priestly kinship, he would profane his offspring among his kin. Zaro be'amav, looking back at the verse there, he should not profane his offspring be'amav, bringing into the tribe of the Kohanim, this woman who is not from the tribe of Kohanim would be a diminution in the honor of the priesthood, if the high priest were to do that. So that's what Rashbam seems to be suggesting, and Shadal is suggesting, and Baruch Levin suggests, and Philo of Alexandria, before the rabbis, writing before we have any rabbinic literature, in his work called The Special Laws, he writes, and besides these commands, Philo wrote in Greek, the summary of what he understood of Jewish law in his days. And besides these commands, he also defined, he meaning God or Moses, the Torah, defined precisely the family of the women who might be married by the high priest, commanding him to marry not merely a woman who was a virgin, but also one who was a priestess. In other words, the daughter of a priest. So Philo of Alexandria thought that was the meaning of the verse, that so both bridegroom and bride might be of one house and in a manner of one blood, so as to display a most lasting harmony and union of disposition during the whole of their lives. If a Kohen marries a woman who is also from a family of Kohanim, it will be a union of lasting harmony. The other Kohanim, were permitted to marry women who were not of the daughters of priests, partly because their purificatory sacrifices are of but small importance. It's not so important to be a regular priest. The high priest is something really special. And partly because he was not willing entirely to disunite and separate the whole nation from the order of the priesthood. And that, in other words, that there was a little bit of democracy in saying that other Kohanim should be allowed to marry anybody that they want from any Jewish tribe. So here we have, if my reading of Rashbam is correct, and Shadal's reading of Rashbam is correct, and Baruch Levine's reading of the text, and Philo of Alexandria, we have all these people saying this. But as you all knew, because you all are deserving of rabbinic ordination, that's not the halakha. The high priest is allowed to marry any Jewish woman. And Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, in his commentary, How Makes Davar, actually came up with, this is the only person I saw who came up with a reason, why would the Torah have to say that Betula Me'amav, if Me'amav means Jewish, then, you know, well, why is it saying this? Well, I'll read it in English. Those of you who want can follow along in the Hebrew. The Netziv says, the text clarified that the high priest should marry only a virgin from his people. It would be fitting that the high priest marry a virgin who excels in wisdom. You know, it'd be a good idea if he really found a wonderful bride. But if he does not find one like that, he should marry any virgin from his people. He can't remain single. That is why he is allowed to marry from his peoples, in other words, from any Jewish group, even the daughter of an Israelite commoner. The Netziv is claiming that the Torah saying this, it's a way of the Torah saying what's really important is that he should get married. And that's why we're saying he should marry anybody, me'amav, and as it looks as if the Netziv may be commenting on the same thing that Perli commented on before, on the plural form here. And the plural is a suggestion from any one of the tribes of the Israelites. Before I published an edition of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, the go-to edition was David Rosin's edition, published in the 1880s. And I shouldn't be so egotistical to say that mine is the go-to. Maybe his is still the go-to edition of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. He just can't accept the idea that Rashbam had this heterodox reading of the text. You know, he knows that the halakha is that the Kohen Gadol can marry any Jewish woman. And so he writes here, Rav Shmuel David Lutzato bebeur HaTorah ta'a b'havanat divrei Rashbam. He didn't understand Rashbam correctly. He's standing up for Rashbam and saying Rashbam would not be offering. And you know, it's possible that Rosin also thinks that like this offhand way that Rashbam offered this non-halachic interpretation just says, Kamo betula me'amav yikach isha, you know, one would think that if he were offering something, pshat interpretation that goes against the halacha, he'd at least, you know, make it clear that he was doing that. Maybe that's bothering Rosin here. So we have this defense of Rashbam's orthodoxy, the small o orthodoxy, that he must have accepted the halakha according to David Rosin. I will go out on a limb and say here that I really think that the pshat, I actually agree with Baruch Levine and Rashbam and Shadal and Philo of Alexandria, that the pshat is that the Torah is interested in the high priest marrying a Kohenet, a priestess, somebody from the tribe of the Kohanim, and that as the years went by, there was this like democratizing legislation. When the halachists came to write the halachot, they didn't want to have such a narrow pool of brides for the high priest, and so they expanded it. That's my feeling about what happened here with the text. Okay, that's issue number two. Issue number three that we will look at today, also from last week's Torah reading, is the section about a priest who has a blemish. This is one of the more troubling texts for us to be reading these days in the 21st century. The text a little further on in last week's Torah portion, the Lord spoke further to Moses, speak to Aaron and say, no man of your offspring throughout the ages who has a defect shall be qualified to offer the food of his God. No one at all who has a defect shall be qualified. No man who is blind or lame or has a limb too short or too long. And then the list of more blemishes goes on. I made the list shorter here, just gave you some of the highlights of the list. And then we go on. Kol isha asher bo mum mizera Aaron HaKohen lo yigash la'akriv et ishei Hashem mum bo et lechem Elohav lo yigash la'akriv. No man among the offspring of Aaron the priest who has a defect shall be qualified to offer the Lord's offering by fire. Having a defect, he shall not be qualified to offer the food of his God. He may eat of the food of his God. So he gets some of the benefits that a priest gets, which is to be allowed to eat truma and various other gifts that are given to the priest, but he just can't have a public, you can't give a public role to somebody who has a blemish, the text is saying. He may eat of the food of his God, of the most holy, as well as the holy, whatever degree of holiness it is, there are two degrees of holiness, Kodashim Kalim and Kodashi Kodashim, he's allowed to eat both of those. But he shall not enter behind the curtain or come near the altar, for he has a defect. He shall not profane these places sacred to me, for I, the Lord, have sanctified them. Okay, as I said, this is a troubling text for us reading it in the 21st century. How do we deal with this text that suggests that somebody who has a blemish cannot be in a position of leadership? You look at a book like Sefer HaChinuch, the 13th century work from Spain, trying to provide the reasons for the mitzvot. It doesn't help very much when you see his attempt to explain the rationale here. I'll start with the second paragraph here just to save time. People who are distinguished in appearance and good in deeds will find favor and make a good impression on all those who see them. You know, we like looking at good looking people and they make a good impression on us. Conversely, if they are diminished in appearance and of strange limbs, even if they behave well, their actions will not influence the minds of those who see them as much. You know, if they've got blemishes, they just won't succeed in being a leader. Accordingly, it is fitting that the representative of the community, the shaliach of the community, should be a man of grace, well-built and handsome and pleasant in all his ways, so that the thoughts of people will be attracted to him. He's saying that psychologically, people who are better looking will have more of a positive influence on the assembled, and because of that, the Torah wants the priest's work to be done only by the people who are well built, people of grace, handsome, pleasant in all their ways. Okay, that's the Sefer HaChinuch. Around the same time as Sefer HaChinuch, a rabbi writing in Germany, a famous rabbi writing in Germany, was asked a question. This is, for those of you who are interested, there's more than one edition of Rabbi Meir of Rotenberg's responsa. This is responsa number 249 in the Cremona edition. That's the one that I was using for preparing this class. I'll read it in English. As to your question, so it's a response to a collection, halakhic questions are submitted to the rabbi and he answers, as to your question, whether a man whose arms have fallen off because of God's quality of strict judgment is worthy of being the shaliach tzibur. Can somebody who doesn't have any arms, or maybe it doesn't have hands, no, zro'otav, that's arms, doesn't have any arms, Can he be the shaliach tzibur? Can he lead the prayers in the synagogue? And he writes, Pshita v'ra'uli v'ra'uihu. It's obvious. Of course, he is certainly worthy. In fact, he said, it is the ideal way of performing the mitzvah. Adarabba, mitzvah min hamuvchar, to have the leader of the community, our shaliach, the person who is representing us, be somebody who has a very serious blemish of this nature, is ra'ui v'ra'ui, certainly worthy. And he goes on, the supreme king of kings prefers to use broken vessels, unlike the preferences of human officials. Melech, I'll read it in Hebrew, it's such a beautiful idea here. Melech malchei amlachim chafetz lehishtamesh b'cheilim shavurim v'lo kederech sarim basar vadam. Maybe our kings here and our princes in the countries where we live, they want to look only at handsome people without any blemishes. But the king, the supreme king of kings, God, prefers people who have a blemish. This does not disqualify them. This actually qualifies them more for the position of leading the community. And so it is written, Lev nishbar v'nidke Elohim lo tevazeh. God, you will not reject a crushed and contrite heart. I think that part of his argument here is that somebody who has suffered like this physically also is an appropriate person to be leading to the community, because, you know, the community suffers, and to have somebody who understands suffering representing the community is for the benefit of the community. But of course, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg knew last week's Torah reading, and so he finishes at the end. He said, only priests are disqualified because of blemishes. That's a rule that applies only to priests. What is Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg doing? He's taking this rule that's a problematic rule, a troubling rule for many of us, and he's restricting it and saying that it only applied to priests. And of course, in the days of Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, there is no temple in Jerusalem. There is no place where the priests can go and conduct their priestly duties of offering sacrifices. I just point out, notice that the text itself says, Ish mizaracha lidorotam, you know, throughout the ages, this law applies. And Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg takes this law, and he restricts it, and he comes out with a position that I think is a position that we in the 21st century can feel very comfortable with, the idea that that somebody who has a blemish can be our leader. There have been a number of responses that have been written recently about the issue, about whether somebody in a wheelchair can be the can be the shaliach tzibur, and the majority position of those who are dealing with that issue today is that somebody in a wheelchair can certainly be the shaliach tzibur. And this leads into the last question, which is a question that actually became more relevant this last year during Corona times, as I will explain as we go on. A blind person reading the Torah, well, of course, how do you read the Torah if you're blind? Well, a lot of people know the Torah reading by heart. When they get up there, how carefully are they looking at the text? They're supposed to be looking. It says in the halakhic literature, you should be, if you're reading the Torah, you should be looking at every word. You shouldn't be looking around and just reciting it from memory because you memorized it. But I'm sure that everybody here knows that the person who receives an aliyah to the Torah, who's called up to the Torah, originally the people who were called up to the Torah, each person did their own Torah reading. When they were called up to the Torah, each person read the section they were called up to read. And even today, the halachic literature says that when you're called up to the Torah, when you receive an aliyah, even if there is a Torah reader who is standing there reading it, you are supposed to be reading along with the Torah reader. You are supposed to be looking at the text and reciting the text along with the Torah reader. So what happens if somebody is blind? So the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Joseph Caro, and the authoritative code of Jewish law writes, Mi she'eino yodea likrot tzarich limchot biyado shelo ya'ale lesefer Torah. A person who doesn't know how to read shouldn't get an aliyah. He should not be called up to the Torah because he can't read the section that he's getting called. So why will he say a blessing if he can't read it? But what happens if the only Kohen that we have there, our custom is to give the first aliyah to a Kohen. What happens if the only Kohen that we have there isn't able to read Hebrew? Well, if you can call him up, and you'll say it word by word, and you'll show the words to him in the Sefer Torah, you'll point to the words in the Sefer Torah, and he will say them after you. So actually, he isn't reading, because he can't identify the letters. He doesn't know how to read it, but he is looking at the letters and saying the word properly. That's okay, says Rabbi Joseph Caro. Grudgingly, he says that that's okay. And then he continues, Suma eino koreh. But a person who's blind cannot read from the Torah. And in the context there, it means he cannot receive an aliyah because it is forbidden to read even one letter, not directly from the written text when you're called up to the Torah. So if you can't see the text, you can't have an aliyah. So that's what Rabbi Joseph Caro wrote in the Code of Jewish Law. However, there were many people who disagreed with him, including this rabbi, Rabbi Benjamin Aaron Salnick, who wrote a book called Masat Binyamin, who gives a kind of impassioned defense of giving an aliyah to a blind person. He wrote here, the Gaon and greatest sage of his generation, Rabbi Yosef Caro, in his work, The Beit Yosef, collected and gathered all the opinions and weighed and evaluated them and came to the conclusion that it is forbidden, that a blind person is not to be called up for an aliyah among those who are counted. That's his summary. He says, Rabbi Joseph Caro, the Shulchan Aruch is the shorter work written by Rabbi Joseph Caro. There's the longer work of the Beit Yosef, where he goes through all the previous literature on the subject and then comes to the conclusion, no way, can't have a blind person getting an aliyah. But Rabbi Salnick goes on, now in my old age, vision has darkened from my windows and my eyes have grown dim from sight. According to what the rabbi Yosef Caro concluded, I will be driven away this day from seeking refuge in the inheritance of the Lord, in the Torah of truth and of eternal life, that I shall not be included in the number of those who are counted to rise up and read the Torah. He's shocked that now that he's losing his vision in his old age, I noticed here that he lived to age 70, so this is in his 60s. He's writing this and saying, I've lost my vision, and therefore I said and I decided in my heart, God forbid that I should abandon the way of the tree of life and cease grabbing onto its branches. And I will now open with a halachic discussion to determine why the rabbi did such a thing to me. Lirot alma asali harav kacha. Why did Rav Yosef Caro treat me like this? Why is he saying that I do not deserve to have an aliyah because I am blind? At the end of the responsum written by Rabbi Spolnick, he concludes that a blind person can have an aliyah, and many, many halachic authorities disagreed with Rabbi Yosef Caro about this issue. the argument, the Rav Yosef Karo, is a strong argument. You're supposed to be reading the Torah. I can't read the Torah. You can't read the Torah. But it seems that another, Menschlichkeit kind of argument trumped that argument, and it became common in synagogues that I've gone to, that people who don't have very good eyesight are called up to the Torah to receive an aliyah. And as I said, this became an issue that was discussed very commonly in the last year in some places. The place where I was davening outdoors most often this year, when it was permitted to pray outdoors here in Israel, which wasn't all the time, but because of social distancing, we had the person who was receiving the aliyah generally standing far away from the Torah reader. And if you're standing far away from the Torah reader, you can't really read what's written in the Torah. And people said, well, the social distancing is very important. We all know how important it is. We all know how important it is to have this social distancing. So since that is the case, then we will rely on the fact that if we are, in essence, making ourselves blind by standing far away from the Torah scroll, we can still have an aliyah. So again, we see a possible movement towards democratization in this in the halachic process. Okay, shall we see what came into the chat?
Sure. Would you like me to do that for you, or
sure, go for it? Yes.
Okay, we'll get to that. If I just may add one little thing, you mentioned on the mumim. We know that, like, this question comes up on duchening, and we're already in the Mishnah, if people are dashvo, if people are used to the defect, like, theoretically, the halacha says if somebody has, some people are going to stare at the person, he can't duchen, but the halacha is if people are used to it, people today, thank God, I guess, are more accepting of handicaps, so it would be okay. I'm wondering, this is sort of a radical question, is there anybody who wants to claim that the psulim in the Torah in Parshat Emor for a coin in the Beit HaMikdash would have that exception to it, that if people, that's only what it should be, but if people, I've never heard that, I'm just throwing that out there as something radical to think about.
I've never heard that either, but you know, Rabbi Kelman, I'm not perturbed when somebody suggests something radical.
No, I realize that. That's why I'm asking you.
But I haven't seen anybody writing.
Right, okay, that. Okay. We'll get to have one other question. If we have time, we'll get to at the end. Okay. I'll go through these. Yes, when you say Kohani, my pet pointing out does not include a Levi, I presume. A Kohen means a Kohen. No longer, a Levi is no longer a Kohen.
Correct.
Okay. Gersha wants to claim that Me'amav, it means a non-Jew, alien nations, as opposed to the way you're
from speaking. Other nations. Okay, Gershon, you can claim that if you'd like. It doesn't seem to me likely, but... thank you for the suggestion. Maybe it means he can't marry a virgin convert, Zev wrote here, and that is actually the halacha, and so that could be what the text is meaning, that she was born into a Jewish family.
Would that apply even if she's under three?
I think so. Yes.
Now, unlike, I think today we assume a Kohen marrying a Gioret, I think, if I recall, only applies if she's after three, but it could be different because whatever, we assume that she might not be of virgin, as strange as that may seem to us. Whereas maybe the Kohen Gadol is different. Mamash has to be born Jewish. It's not that fear. I don't know. Okay. If anybody knows, okay. Amim Har Yikra'u, Amim is the tribes of Israel. Okay.
Chaim Bess. Right. There are a number of times when it means that. There's no question. All TV anchors are good looking. Good point, Susanna. That's true. Yeah. They only put people who are good looking as the TV anchor.
iPad just pointing out that way, if you get married at 20, you got appointed as the high priest. Let's say you didn't marry. You didn't marry a betula, and then you get appointed the high priest. So the Mishnah already talks about that. If you're meuras to, you were engaged, legally engaged, you can marry even the Kohen. Now, you would not force the Kohen Gadol to divorce his wife. A Kohen who marries a non-betula and then gets appointed the Kohen Gadol, as I understand that the halacha would allow him to become the Kohen Gadol. The Mishnah talk a little bit about that. Okay. Any times, Robert wants to know, any other times the word amav is used in the Chumash?
It's not a common word, and we can't really extrapolate from other uses. And as Pearlie pointed out right away, that it's not saying ne'amo, which is a more common form that you might be expecting. I see that Herb Basser chimed in here and says that Josephus actually writes that every priest has to marry from the priestly family, and Josephus was a priest. Was a priest himself. So Josephus disagreeing with Philo and with the halacha.
iPad before that wanted to know: is there any comparison between this law and the law of inheritance, where before Tubav, you had to marry your own coin, so with Benot Slavchot, so the land wouldn't transfer from one sheva to another. But I don't know why there'd be a problem, because the son would be a Kohen anyways. I mean, even if a Kohen marries somebody from God, the son's a Kohen. It goes by the male. Only Jewishness goes by the female.
Yes.
Let's see, more questions here. Josephus, exactly. Okay. Marty Crissell, it's always a pleasure. Pointing out that he reads from the Haftorah. Those who know Marty from Toronto, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that you read the Haftorah and from a wheelchair. Very nice.
I'm delighted that your shul allows that, and whatever shul it is, I hope to get there and daven there at a shul that that allows things like that.
That's okay. Right, I'm assuming, I don't know if what Sam is making is a comment, the chazan on Hineni is just saying, accept my prayers as someone who's got all the qualifications, means he taka doesn't. In other words, we allow the chazan, and that's talking really on the moral virtues, I think, Hineni, even though I'm not such a tzaddik and I'm not such a this and a that, please accept me. I think kal vachomer for physical issues. Okay. I think the Yemenite minhag is still that the Oleh reads from the Torah, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Is that,
if you don't mind, I've got a funny story to tell about the custom of that there are still some synagogues where the person who is called up is asked to read the Torah. So I heard a story, I won't name the rabbi, but a well-known rabbi from the United States who is a Kohen, once was visiting here in Israel, and he was staying in a hotel, and he went to the closest shul that he could find, and it was a shul where they expected each person to read his own section from the Torah when he was called up. And when it came to call people up to the Torah, they said, is there a Kohen here? And he put up his hand, and he was the only person there, and he came up there, and he was looking to see where the Torah reader was, and there wasn't a Torah reader there, and he read it, and he said he was so embarrassed. He felt afterwards that he had embarrassed the American rabbinate because he had butchered this section. So the next time that he went back to Israel, he stayed at the same hotel, and he went to the same shul, and before he went to shul, he prepared the Torah reading for the Kohen's Aliyah, and he went to shul, and they asked, is there a Kohen here? And he put up his hand, and they called him up to the Torah, and he said the blessing, and he read the Torah, and all was fine. And then they said, is there a Levi here in shul? and there wasn't a Levi there, and they said, okay, we call up the Kohen to read the second Aliyah. Also, he was not prepared for that. And his when he told the story, he said, "When you are a rabbi, you always have to be prepared." It was the conclusion that he came to from this story.
If I can, in the days when we used to be able to travel, so our sort of we had when we were in Morocco the summer of 2019, went to shul and that was the time where there was an extra parsha. If you travel from Israel, Chukat Balak, you know, the double parsha, because the last day of Pesach was on Shabbos. So they finished laning. And then there was a whole discussion. They said, let's lane the second parsha, like to make up, like for the people from Israel. So some guy, they looked around, they called up. Okay, they gave some guy an aliyah. And like, he just laned the whole parsha, like some guy without, like, were there people who, and, you know, the Sephardic community, Yemeni community, they can just lane like that. It's a beautiful thing. Of course, I don't really understand how it's halachically allowed. That's a separate problem. I don't understand, because we instituted a balkore exactly not to embarrass people. Rabbi. So I don't exactly know what the heter is for this. And, you know, if even if from what I said, Rav Soloveitchik didn't like it sometimes, like at a youth meeting, you know, they give out like 7 aliyot, and each kid who would get in the parsha would get his aliyah. You know, he didn't think that was appropriate, because the takana is you dafka have a balkore not to embarrass somebody. But okay, anyways, that's interesting. Yes, that's... what can we say? Had they called me up to lane without notice, I also would have been, I don't know if I would have been embarrassed, but I also would have, you know, butchered it. So anyways, okay, if I may ask you one last quick question before, of course, at 12:15, Lori Novick, today continuing her series on women in Kriyat HaTorah, and today this topic's on Kvod HaTzibur. I think Dr. Lakshin, you're more than invited to stay. I know you're busy, but of course, this is a subject you've dealt with.
Subject that I'm interested in, yes.
Today, so she'll be talking on the issue of Kvod HaTzibur, which of course is the basic issue of can a woman have an aliyah? The Gemara says yes, and the Gemara says, but we shouldn't do it because of Kvod HaTzibur. So that's going to be in 13 minutes. But I can just ask you very quickly, maybe you want to comment on it next week, because I think we got through all the questions.
I still have a question.
Okay. You want to go ahead, or you want to you'll get the phone, I'll ask the question. So
because I left the phone off. Several things. One is the comment about the high priest is without mum, but remember the animal that he's offering also has to be.
That's right, for sure.
Maybe there's a connection.
Yes, the lists are very similar. You're right, Pearlie. The lists are very similar of the blemishes of the animal and the blemishes of the priest. They're not identical, but they're similar. Yeah.
So that's one maybe, but the other. Another point is the issue of the aliyah is different today than it was then, because in your shul, Marty, or in mine for the most part, the aliyah is simply the bracha.
That's
not a question of reading. Look, I can't see to read the Torah anymore, and I was a really good